April 3rd, 2007, is the Lot from Pedro Show. Watt from Pedro show. We started with Tapestry and Sound, something from Live in Seattle, John Coltrane. Of course, that's only Jimmy Garrison, and I've played that before, but I thought I should play it again in honor of my guest. We'll hear him talk from Brooklyn over the phone to me. We did that a little earlier today. Tony Mamone, a big bass hero to me. Incredible cat. A lot of influence on my bass playing. He's played with a number of bands. Perubu, probably people know of, but he's done all kinds of stuff. We'll talk about things he's done and is doing. After Mr. Garrison worked the bass there, we had Migu with In You, In Me, A Dream. And now here's the first part of the interview I did with Tony, well, like I said earlier today, April 3rd, 2007. And we'll go up to the first hour and then the rest of it in the second hour. I'm here in my pad in Pedro because I got to leave for tour soon and couldn't make it over to Brother Matt's, the Love Grotto and the Pleasure Point there. So missing Brother Matt, but glad to have Tony on board. And, yeah, we actually spoke first Sunday on D. Boone's birthday a few days ago, April 1st. But some fucking hums and stupidness on my part screwed up the recording, so we had to do it again today. And I'm much grateful to Tony for bearing with me and coming through. He is a true bass brother. So here's that spiel now. A lot from Pedro show.
New York Pedro.
Yeah, and this time I've got it together.
Yeah, man, techno, right? There's just so much. You know, one little dot isn't dotted or one little T isn't crossed and the whole shebang is just somewhere else.
Yeah, it was totally blanketed with but it was what you had to say was so fucking happening, so let's go for it again, man.
Well, you know, our conversation's still pretty fresh in my mind, so
yeah, good. I mean, we started at the beginning, you on bass.
Yeah, man. I remember you asked me what my first amp was. It was like a Trainer. Do you remember those things? They had a fan in them. They were so heavy.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and the 215s in two cabinets. So I had them both in my living room. And, you know, I was thumping along. I think my first bass back then was a Rickenbacker. I don't even know why I got a Rickenbacker, but I got a P-Bass shortly thereafter.
Right, but actually you told me you had some body thing in Florida.
That's right. You see, man, you're a good reporter. Because you remember. Yeah, so what, I remember now. Yeah, it was like
because you had moved from Cleveland.
Right, and I remember I brought a little red SG down with me. I was picking around on that like a little guitar, you know, and just, you know, playing some chords, but not really feeling it. And then somebody left this Univox, like, semi-hollow body that was, you know, it truly was. It was like a kind of plastic body with a wooden neck. And I remember I had some old stereo that you could, it had a jack that you could plug a quarter-inch jack into. And so I said, well, look at that, you know. So I plugged in. And there it was, like I had some bass cooking.
This is right before the Trainer, you're playing right through the stereo.
Yeah, and I remember I was listening to one of those Rolling Stone bootlegs. You know, I think it was called Bright Lights. Bright Lights, Something City, you know. And I thought, oh yeah, man. Like, so they were playing all these old blues tunes, and so I noticed that I could just thump right along with just right out of the box. So I'm like, So I started pulling out like all these records that I'd been listening to. I'd been like listening to a bunch of blues and jazz. I remember I was listening to Ahmad Jamal. Like, I was really digging his piano playing back then.
Oh, yeah. I read about him in the Miles autobiography. That was his favorite piano player. But he had to settle for playing with Red Garland, and it always bummed him out.
Right, because Ahmad didn't want to get on the Miles train.
But he would have been with Coltrane.
Well, man, you know, and I wonder if he ever had second thoughts about that, you know.
Yeah, Miles said that piano was too busy and stuff, and he liked the way that Ahmad laid out and stuff and gave space.
Yeah. He was so beautiful, so lyrical. And I remember I was listening to him, and I was listening to, like, the Duke Ellington Trio stuff.
Oh, Blanton.
I think I also mentioned, too, that record, that one, This One's for Blanton, which was a record that Duke had dedicated to Jimmy Blanton, who was like one of his favorites and who was one of the first bass players to go up there and get melodic on him, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Nobody had done that before. Jimmy Blanton was one of the first ones, so...
Groundbuster.
Yeah, man, he did this record with Ray Brown. It's just a duet, man. It's on Pablo. That record, man, I'd recommend that to anybody. It's just a beautiful record. And
like Dose.
And then there's another really great record that Duke made with Coltrane. And it's called In a Sentimental Mood. And, like,
yeah. You
know, that's like, I think that's one of the first songs on the record. And, you know, like when Coltrane plays that line, that theme, and then Duke Ellington answers him.
It's a dialogue.
It's like one of those minutes. That's one of those moments in music that, like, when you hear it for the first time, you never forget it. You know, like, I remember the first time I heard the Television record, you know. There were some moments like that for me on that record, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Fred Smith.
But anyway, I was listening to a lot of jazz and blues, and so I started thumping along, and, you know, one thing led to the other. But, you know, there was no one to jam with down in Fort Lauderdale, man. Like, I didn't know any musicians down there. You know, I was driving a cab, you know. So anyway, I ended up going back up to Cleveland, and I moved into this place called The Plaza, which is over on 32nd and Prospect. It was a building that Alan Ravenstein and Dave Bloomquist had, and they had a bunch of artists and musicians living there, and I heard about it, and I moved in, and all of a sudden I realized that Peter Lochner's across the hall from me, and Albert Dennis, this really great bass player, was living upstairs. So, you know, Albert, everybody was going, you know, walking up and down the stairs. And, of course, these old buildings, you hear everything. Everybody could hear me thumping, you know. So the one guy, Albert Dennis, he goes, hey, you know, if you ever want to come up and talk bass or grab a lesson or anything, man, like, feel free. So, you know, I went up to this cat's place and, you know, he showed me how to play some scales. And just all just opened up real fast for me. I'm like, oh, man, yeah. I could get with this. So I was spending some time just really practicing. And before anything really happened down there, like on the Ubu scene, I remember I met this black dude. He said they were looking for a bass player and it was like 93rd and Union, which was pretty hardcore ghetto for Cleveland. Actually pretty much still is kind of wild over there. And I remember I had one of those trainer cabinets. I had to bring my cabinet. I had it like on my shoulder, like I just like kind of leaning on the wall and like just kind of huffing up the stairs on my own with my bass in my other hand. And I think I had like, you know, a backpack, you know, I was afraid to leave anything like down for a minute, you know. But anyway, once I got in there, those people were so beautiful. And the fact that I could play some rock, this guy, Willie, he was so into that because he wanted to play like some of like the Band of Gypsies stuff and like some of the Cream stuff. And, you know, I was way into playing that stuff. So that was really my first band, you know. And I played with those guys for a little while, but it was kind of, you know, they weren't doing a lot, you know, but what they were doing was stuff that you'd never, ever forget. Like, I remember our first gig was at a place called the Velvet Rail on Union, which was a topless joint. And we were the entertainment in between, like, you know, I mean, I guess there was like an early show and a late show, and I think Willie knew the bar owner, so he's going to let us play. So we went in there and played our little set, you know, and I thought to myself, well, now, okay, this is cool, but, you know, there's got to be a little more. I mean, we'd go over to Dude's house to practice, and, like, you know, I'd see, like, guys that have, like, you know, guy'd have a holster, like, with his gun in it, like, just kind of on his bed, like, cowboy style. So I'm like, okay. And then I moved down to the Plaza, and I kept practicing. I was still playing with those guys, but we didn't have that much stuff going on. And then Peter Lautner came over one day. He brought a six-pack. He brought, like, this reggae sampler. He brought, like, a Link Ray record. And he brought, like, the first Bob Marley record. And, you know, we sat down there and we had a couple beers. And Peter just, like, you know, that cat was such a great musician. And he had this way. You know, he was so masterful, like, the way he would grab a tune and start playing it, that you could just jump right in and you were in it on that level with him. And, you know, one thing led to the other with Peter, and, you know, right away, like, Peter wanted a gig, you know. I mean, he had, at that point, he had already left Pararubu. And so he and I and Anton Fear, we started practicing out at Anton's house out in Euclid, down in the basement. And, like, we were learning stuff like, you know, Calvary Cross and, like, Prove It, the television tune, and, you know, what else did we do?
This is the band Friction. He called
Yeah,
Friction.
That was Friction. And that was, like, really, like, my first band, like what you might say, like, within the community, you know?
Right. Oh, they were still called Rocket from the Tombs when he left?
Yeah, like, what happened was Peter and David and Cheetah Chrome, those cats had done Rocket from the Tombs. And then David, for whatever reason, that thing kind of morphed into Pararubu with some different players, like Peter and David and Scott Krause were the only guys that went from Rocket to Ubu.
Okay.
Now, like, Alan Ravenstein, like, played on, I think the way it worked was Alan played on the first Ubu single. And then the second Ubu single, I think Dave Taylor played synthesizer, and Alan, you know, I can't remember what it was. Alan kind of stepped out of the band for a minute. And then they were at a place where, like I told you on a Sunday, nobody was really, really happy rocking bass. Everybody was kind of taking turns playing bass, but was really looking towards playing guitar.
They had Tim Wright.
Yeah. Tim Wright, Tom Herman, and Peter. And then it went to where it was just Tom Wright and Tim Wright and Tom Herman up playing guitars. And then I guess what it was David and Tom came to see the first Friction show, which was at a small space up in Cleveland Heights. And after the show, they asked me if I wanted to jam with the band, and I said yeah. And Peter at that time, he was coming up to New York a lot. He was writing a lot of articles for Cream magazine, and he was really, really trying to get into television. He was hanging out, you know, with Patti Smith and television. Like, you know, Peter knew everybody.
Did you go to that Piccadilly Inn gig?
Yeah, man.
Because that's the first.
The bar.
Oh, you were tending the bar.
Yeah, man.
Because that's the first television gig in Cleveland, right?
That's right. And
I've got somebody flowed me some CDs of that.
Like, is Richard Hell on that record? Is Richard Hell on that gig? Or was it already Fred?
It's 70.
I can't remember.
It's 75. I think it might be still, Richard Hell.
Yeah, it was Richard Hell. And there was a bunch of bands played up there. Johnny Thunders played up there. Those are the two big ones that I remember.
It was 2 days, right? What was that gig like?
It was like amazing. It was an amazing show. Like to, the sound wasn't the best in there, you know? But it was really good. But I gotta say that, like, my moment with television didn't really come until the first time, like, Uba was going to play up at CBGB's. And the night before we were in town, we went down there, and I walked in there, and they were playing Marquee Moon. And that was one of those moments, like, where, you know, you hear something, and you kind of have an epiphany, because you have never heard anything like that before, and something clicks inside your brain. Those guys, they didn't have any pedals. Like, they had a couple of twin reverbs, and I think, I think Tom Verlaine was playing like a Jaguar, and I think Richard Hell was,
Lloyd.
Richard Lloyd, thank you. He was playing, Telecaster, and Fred was just playing like a P bass. So, and no pedals. But the sound was so amazing, man. The way it was vibrating around the room, that was just a moment I'll never forget. Now, going back to the Piccadilly, when I saw them play there, I mean, they played Little Johnny Jewel. It was really great, but it maybe it was the acoustics in the room and the PA, which was nothing like what they had at CBGB's. Nothing at all. It didn't ring the bell as hard as it did when I saw him at Stevie's, like with a real PA system. But that was a funny gig for me because the plaza, the place where I lived at, was just two blocks down the street. So I'd walk down there and I'd tend bar three nights a week, make a load of cash, and then the rest of the time I was just practicing.
Right.
And So we did that gig with Peter, and then I did a few other gigs with Peter, but Peter was, coming up to New York a lot, and, he was drinking a lot. He was drinking a lot, taking a lot of pills, and he had a really strong constitution, but it wasn't strong enough to withstand that, you know, week in and week out, month in and month out. And, like, he was the first cat that we lost, you know?
Yeah.
He was young, too. I don't even think Peter was, like, 26 years old when he passed.
Wow.
Yeah, man. An amazing talent. Like I said the other day, like, Peter was definitely one of the main, one of my main influences as far as, you know, listening to music and playing music. Another person who had a really profound effect on me was Scott Krause, because Scott always worked at record stores, and so Scott always had this deep, deep, deep record collection. And I've spent like more than 1,000 hours listening to music with Scott Krause, just all the stuff that I'd never heard before, like the Velvets, you know, like Eno, like those really early Fleetwood Mac records, like with Peter Green on guitar.
Right.
I remember Scott had this Peter Green record called The End of the Game, which we used to like sit up there and listen to that music and, you know, roll with the hashish, and it would just get darker and darker and darker, and the music, it gets so deep, like listening to like that Fripp stuff, that Fripp and Eno stuff, and just really, just all sorts of music. And you know, Scott and I, like, we bonded that way, you know, like listening to the Dub, man. Like, we were listening to Dub way back, like, you know, like back, like when, you know, like a lot of the music that you would get would be white label stuff, like from Jamaica. And Sun Ra, like these Sun Ra records that you could tell that, like, the Sun Ra band actually, like, they were hand coloring, like, the labels and stuff. So Scotty and I, we listened to all that stuff. So those cats, like, for me, coming up from, you know, I mean, back then in the early 70s, Florida, man, it was still pretty disco down there, you know, which I got nothing against disco. I actually love disco. But, you know, I had like a Velvets record. I had some of the stuff, but, you know, coming back up to Cleveland, and Cleveland at that time was really cooking because, all the bands were coming through, like T-Rex came through and Roxy Music came through, and we saw Bob Marley play at a small club, like at the Agora, the small Agora, back over there on 23rd Street or 22nd Street.
I played under some place called the Pop Shop.
Yeah, the Pop Shop. Did you guys rock the Pop Shop?
Yeah, with Black Flag in 83, I think. So it was like its last days. I think that Agora burned down or something.
Yeah.
I remember the Romantics were upstairs. I saw Bob Marley at UCLA in 79.
Man, I feel like we're lucky to have, you know, to have seen that band and seen Bob, you know.
Oh, yeah. He's incredible. And Family Man, we were talking. That guy was righteous
Family
on the
man.
Bass.
You know, anybody that really wants to understand bass, just grab any Bob Marley record and zero in on Family Man, because dude is not playing like, you know, he's not doing like Jaco. He's not doing like Entwistle. You know, he's like playing really, really kind of slow a lot of the time. But what that cat does with the space, right?
Yeah.
He's a master of the one drop, you know? They let the one drop because, like, if you're grooving with it, and then they let that one drop away, you kind of, you've been leaning against the bass, and for a moment it's not there. And then they come up and catch you on the upswing, you know?
Oh, yeah. Pushes it good.
Catch you flat-footed and keep you dancing.
Now, I heard you guys had a residency at a place called Pirate Cove, later was Peabody Underground when I played it there on the flats.
Man, that was a spot, Mike. That place, that was so formative, like, for Ubu, because, like, you know, check it out. Like, we were rehearsing, like, we would rehearse. I can't really remember. I think it was kind of, like, rehearse, like, on a Sunday night, and then meet again on the Monday, take a day off, and then play on Wednesday. Like, those were our three rehearsal days. Then Thursday, we knew we had this gig at the Pirates Cove. So it was a great laboratory for us to, like, you know, write the tunes and then go right down there and see how they, you know, see how they stuck on the wall, you know?
Right.
Typical, you know, 70s joint, like, all, like, black walls, you know? Typical. With a little backstage, and then they expanded eventually, but originally it was pretty modest operation down there, but for us it was great because we had a place to play, and we had a place to, you know, invite our friends to play with us, like DeVoe would come up and play with us, and Tin Huey would come and play with us, and all of Peter Lochner's bands would always, like, share a gig here and there with us.
Now, the first thing you record is the single, right?
Right, like, they had already, the original band already had the two singles under their belts. They had 30 Seconds Over Tokyo, and they had Final Solution.
Yeah.
So the first single I cut with the band was Street Waves. Cloud 14. Oh, no, the other side was My Dark Ages.
Oh, that's right.
And, you know,
and it was on David's label, right? Hey Arthur.
Yeah, Hey Arthur. know, that tune, you know, like, you know the way it opens up? It opens up like with like a, just like a little lick on the bass that goes like, ba-da-da-da. It's like D, D sharp E on the A string and then hit the open E, right?
Right.
And that was just, so much of the ooh stuff was just stuff I was practicing. You know? Because like, I was working on octaves, you know? And then, and I was just like, wow, that sounds so good. Ba-da-da-da. And, yeah, that was kind of like one of the first things that I wrote with Ubu was Street Waves. And I remember that other one I told you the other night was when at that first rehearsal, everybody was like, you know, like just jamming hard and there was all this noise. And I remember like, you know, Al Dennis always telling me that, like, you know, playing bass, remember that space is the other side of bass. So if you choose not to play, that's as important as when you do play. And so these guys were all like playing, and I was trying to find a place to fit in, and all of a sudden I remembered that. And so I just stopped, you know?
Yeah.
Turned up the amp a little bit, and then I just hit that big open A, you know, and then like fretting like the A on the G string, just bam. And then just stopped and let all their, like, cacophony ring over that and then just play, like, the next note, which was B. And plus, like, I was really into that whole giant steps theory, you know, like, coming up, like, with, you know, like, something that might be just called, like, well, just like a simple, like, riff or ostinato or whatever anyone would call it.
Figure.
And that underneath something that's much more like dense and full of information could be a good thing to do. And so for me, like, Ubu was great back then because I was so into, you know, like studying stuff and just working on bass that I had this wonderful opportunity to try out all my stuff like in a live situation, and you know, I was really happy with that, you know.
Then the first album, Modern Dance.
Right, and the first album, you know, the first two singles we recorded at the Hammond's other studio, which they had on Euclid Avenue. I can't remember the name of that studio, but I know that it wasn't called Suma. That's what they called their new studio, which was out in Painesville in this beautiful house, like, you know, like on top of a hill, like at the edge of the hill were trees, and it went down into this ravine. And,
oh, yeah. I was telling you, I got to do a fire hose record there from Ohio.
That's right.
Just because you guys recorded there, and it was fall, so all the trees were orange and yellow, and it was righteous.
Yes, wasn't that an amazing, I mean, it still is, like, Paul Hammond is still rocking it hard out there. I mean, him and David are just working, just finishing a numbers band record out there. And anyway, going out to Suma and recording was just like a dream come true. Because the first studio was amazing. And just to, like I remember, I was riding my bike over the Williamsburg Bridge today, and I was thinking back about that and thinking that we were going to have this conversation. And that was the first time I was in a studio, and I remember we were mixing Street Waves, and I understood that, you know, all the faders on the console control, like, individual sounds from individual instruments. And that just blew me away, like, the fact that, you know, you could have that much control over a record. And so when we got out to Suma, you know, Ken Hammond, Paul's dad, he had built the board that we were to record on out there. He actually built the board. And because he had had a long career as a radio engineer, he had, and I believe Paul still has, the most extensive, like, tube microphone collection in the whole state of Ohio. I mean, for sure the state of Ohio. Maybe even east of the Mississippi. I don't know, but I remember looking at the mic closet and just seeing all these amazing German microphones. And remember how that live room is there?
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's a big wooden floor and the fireplace. So
yeah, we did an album called From Ohio there because, yeah, it was done in Ohio.
Mike, I got to hear that record, man.
Yeah, it was great working with them cats. And plus it had, you know, you guys' history and so influential on us. So you go there. And you were telling me, in those days you had all the tunes worked out before you went in the studio.
Yeah, we had everything worked out. I mean, at that point, we already had like some of the songs under our belts that were going to become other songs. But you know, we were really disciplined. Like we had like a certain amount of tunes that we said, okay, we're going to do this. And you know, back then, man, vinyl, right? You had to figure it out because you really could only get 22 minutes. Per side.
Yeah.
So it was a really easy way to be disciplined about how much you were actually going to, you know, set out to do.
Oh, the last tune, Chinese Radiation, that was improvised.
That was improvised. And you know what? I was thinking about our conversation. Also, that song, Sentimental Journey, that's an improvisation.
Okay.
Now, Chinese Radiation, I remember Tom had that guitar lick, which is a great lick. And we had played that, and then somehow we got this idea that this piano piece that I'd been playing and Scott had been playing drums to would work really good as an end to Chinese Radiation.
Yeah.
But that was an improvisation, albeit a short one, whereas Sentimental Journey, I think that's like at least like a 4-minute tune.
Yeah.
That's the one like where David's breaking glass.
Right, walking through a house, it sounds like.
Right. And
or
like
the story of the lyrics.
Right. What he's doing is we'd been drinking orange juice. And back then, for whatever reason, like the orange juice was in like those Tropicana bottles.
Yeah.
So they were all stacked up. And so, you know, at one point David got the idea, oh yeah, big stone fireplace in a recording studio, lots of glass bottles. So that's like, and that's like an amazing thing, like how when the first loud hit drops, that actually, I think the bottle breaks, and then we drop the hit, you know? Well, that was kind of improvised as well. All the other tunes, like even Over My Head, like with the guitar solo and stuff, it wasn't always worked out, like, you know, exactly how long it was going to be. Like, if Tom wanted to keep going, he'd keep going, and we'd just keep riffing along with him. And then as he'd bring the solo to an end, then the bass would start playing harmonics again. Like we would have little tricks like that to signal to each other where we were going.
Cues.
But basically, like I said, yeah, it was worked out ahead of time. Like we were pretty much, you know, rehearsed and ready to go.
And you made it for a label, like a little side mouse thing off of Mercury called Blank.
Right. Clive Bernstein, who managed like Def Leppard and all these huge like metal bands. I know Def Leppard was one of them, like the biggest one. And he had gotten a hold of those Ubu singles. And I remember he came to see us at the Pirates Cove one night. Little dude wearing an army jacket, you know, with a long beard, you know, and apparently, like, an industry insider who is, like, really well-respected and well-known. But that's what he did. He formed, like, a little subsidiary label, Blank, but it really was Phonoground. I remember getting, like, all the James Brown records, like, you know, they said, hey, man, you want some records? I said, you guys got any James Brown records? Which I got that anthology record, which is a great record.
Yeah.
But so, yeah, that's what happened. And And then we were out on the road, right?
Right, and that's where us Minutemen, D. Boone, Georgie, and myself, went and saw you guys at the Whiskey, and it was an incredibly profound experience for us. Like, wow.
Man, I can't believe
we had heard the record before that, but man, live, it was like, oh my God.
You know what, man? Like, it's just the challenge of music is trying to get that live experience recorded. Really hard to do.
Well, I think you guys did it, man. That gig was like, wow, it blew our minds. And it gave us the confidence to try our own thing with Minutemen. Your bass playing, big effect on me. That lick in non-alignment pack and street waves. Yeah, the way you make it breathe with the holes. And it's just great.
Yeah, man, it's all about breathing, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, big time. But to have it taught to you in the moment, you know, watching the Sensei deliver the lesson, it was righteous. And plus, it's also a gig, man. It's a trip. So it's different than a school. Well, it's a kind of school. It was a trip for us. We really, really loved
that. The guys went to school, like, we, you know, you go and you see each other play. And I remember seeing you play, and I was blown away, like, by the abandon that, like, you bring to the art of playing. And actually, when I saw you, that had a really profound effect on me that I needed. You know, like, we, you know, like, you take, like, you take something from everyone, and, like, you know, if you're really on the path, like, you see somebody great play, you walk away inspired and influenced, you know?
Thank you, Tony. You, bro, no, I thought you were going to say, hey, those are my licks.
I'd be pretty fast to steal some of your licks, man.
So, Scott lost the boat that night. He forgot where it was parked.
Yeah, like, couldn't find the boat. Woke up in the morning, he's looking and looking and looking, and no van, you know? So it took us a while, because, you know, man, like, L.A.'s a big town. You could do some, you know, like, you can walk a long time and not even go that far.
Yeah.
But we found it, you know. Man, those were some good times, those early tours, you know?
Well, then you guys go overseas, and it's a lot different, right? Big acceptance. Well, their punk scene had already been going, and ours was kind of tiny. And so, Ubu has some recognition, some validation on a gig-goer level.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we did, we were on Rough Trade at that point, so we were playing, like, with a lot of the Rough Trade bands. Like, you know, I remember we did a gig with Rip Rig and Panic. And, like, this was, like, you know, like, you know, I hadn't heard stuff like this. These were people who were into punk, but they were also, like, really into funk.
Some of those guys came from the pop group. That band was pretty wild.
Yeah, and the pop group, like, we did a bunch of shows with the pop group.
Yeah, they had some smoking bass.
Those are great guys, man. I wish I was still in touch with those guys. That bass player was killing.
Yeah, monster.
Wow.
I met the singer a year and a half ago. I played a festival with his band Mafia. And
what are they called?
Mafia. And he had
wow.
Doug Wimbush on bass, who's pretty... Yeah, I like that guy a lot. I think he's from Connecticut or something, but man, he was... But the singer, Mark Stewart, that's his name.
That's right.
He still has that voice. He's a really tall cat.
Yeah.
See, because these guys were... They were just records, you know? They never toured over here. We never saw them. It was different than Ubu. So we only knew them from their sounds. And so when I met him last year, or a year and a half ago, it was like, wow, you're tall.
Yeah, he was a big guy, right?
Yeah, especially for England, you know. And
all
I told a lot of jokes. But he told me they were just teenagers.
Yeah, they were young.
God, they could play like motherfuckers, oh man.
Yeah, but they were really young. I mean, like teenagers. And then running across these great bands, like, you know, doing a tour with the Gang of Four and Delta Five, like playing, I think it was something like 23 or 24 shows. Or maybe it was 30. It was a huge amount of shows, one after the other. We were all like in a bus. And it wasn't even like a tour bus of like what you have now. It was more like a traveling coach.
Yeah.
And that was like a really good time. And Hugo and John King and all those guys. And then Delta Five, like Beth and that whole crew.
Oh, they had two bass players.
Yeah, they had two bass players. Roz, Beth played guitar. Remember the other cat's name who played the other bass. But it was just like, that was the time. People were just trying just different stuff, fun stuff. And then seeing all these great bands like Susie and the Banshees and seeing like the pop group. And I remember the first time I saw the Mekons, man. Little did I know that group of people were going to have such a huge impact on me, and that I was going to end up, like, you know, playing like Steve Goulding, the drummer. He comes to the studio now, and like, I mean, Steve's the kind of drummer, he can like hear a song, like you play him the song in the control room, and then he'll go out and he kind of like can lay it out like in a couple takes. And then, you know, John Langford, still going, he's one of the few people I still go out on the road with. But I remember the first time I saw them was up in Leeds. We were sharing a bill with them, and I thought, who is this crazy band? Everybody's dancing on stage, and so man, yeah, Europe was profound.
And you guys come back and you do Dubhouse, and you already had some of them songs going. Worked out, right?
Yeah, we were already playing some of those songs. And, you know, Dub Housing, there's more keyboards on Dub Housing. I was playing more keyboards than just like practicing and playing like piano. And so out at the studio, out at Suma there, they had that beautiful grand piano. Beautiful. It's either a Steinway. Yeah, I think it's a Steinway. And they have like a Hammond B3, so you know, I played some Hammond and some piano on that. And at that point, like Ubu was still, you know, we were still like, you know, like kind of like a band the way we were when we had formed. But coming back from Europe, things started to change. You know, like the politics, things started to happen, and. You know, like the guitarist and the drummer and the bass player, we wanted to go out on the road. You know, like Cliff Bernstein, you know, he said, you know, Howard Devoto and the Buzzcocks, they want you guys to do a big tour with them. And, like, for me, that was like, yes, let's do it. And for Scotty, too, and for Tom. But, you know, the other guys in the band, they didn't really want to open for anyone. Like, that was like a, I think that was part of the reason. The other reason was Alan just, he was the landlord of the building that some of us were living in, and he had responsibilities if he wasn't comfortable leaving to go on tour. So, that was kind of bittersweet, because here we were coming back from Europe, lots and lots of press, big shows, and the next logical thing would have been to go out and open for somebody. But it didn't happen, and I think that was the beginning of some disenchantment that Tom started to have. And I think after that third record, A New Picnic Time, you know, Tom, you know, gave notice and said he was stepping out.
Right.
And just like we had talked about the other day, the first time we had been to Europe, we had met Mayo, and some of us had recorded.
Oh, yeah, you're on that Soldier Talk record.
Soldier Talk.
Yeah. Right.
So Mayo got invited into the band, and we, you know, we started up again, and you know, I had a relationship with Tom, like a writing relationship, that was very, very casual, but very, very effective. Like, we came up with a lot of stuff, and it wasn't quite like that with Mayo, like I said the other day. He's coming from a school, I think, like where he wrote a lot of the stuff kind of on his own. But you know, we came up with stuff together. I remember that song, Misery Goats. First three notes on the bass, just back and forth. Because by then I was like, you know, playing some upright, and that was one of my exercises. So I just used that for the bass line for the song.
This is for Art of Walking.
Right.
And where was that done? Is that at Summa too?
Yeah, you know what? Every single Perubu album that I was involved in, except for, there was one record we did out in Stoughton, Massachusetts. We did it at this place, might have been called like the Dugout. And it was where, Bob had done some recording. I think it's where Bob Mould made the Sugar record, and he was telling me about it. He said it was a nice, tight little studio with a Trident board, and that was like where Ubu went to cut, I think, the record before Story of My Life, which, I can't remember which one that was. I don't think it was Worlds in Collision or Cloudland. It was after Cloudland. But all the other albums we ever made, Mike, were at Summa. And I know that David now pretty much works out of Summa exclusively.
Right.
Also, that's like where Scott and I made the Home and Garden records.
Which is your side project that you guys do while you're in Uber.
The first real side project, we did some recording at a studio. Scotty started it at a studio in like downtown Cleveland. And then then we recorded that History and Geography record on an 8-track machine, an 8-track Otari. And like what I said yesterday, or Monday, or Sunday, was that Scott has gone back and, Ryan from Exit Stencil, those two guys, they spent all of last summer remixing and remastering History and Geography, which is the record that Scotty and I made with Jim Jones and Jeff on vocals. And it's amazing, man. They did a really good job. And when you get that, you'll get a chance to hear it.
And Jim Jones is the guy.
Stuff, man, because we cut that in 81, which was like such a long time ago. And, you know, it still stands.
yeah. Jim Jones is the guy who replaced Mayo, right? Mayo only lasts a couple albums.
Right. And then Jim, who had already been on the road with us as a guitar tech, comes on board. And that's when David, from about 82, 81 actually, David's out doing a solo thing. He does one record, Sounds of the Sand, then he does another one with another group that he calls the Pedestrians, which is Chris Cutler on drums and Lindsey Cooper on bassoon and like effects. And David asked me to join if I'm interested. And so,
April 3rd, 2007, it's the second hour of the Watt from Pedro show, and here's the second part of my interview with Tony Mamone earlier today over the phone with him from Brooklyn.
We did some playing, and we ended up writing a record together and going on the road together. So here I am back on the road with David, Chris Cutler, and Lindsey playing like in Texas like, you know, playing shows with Reverend Horton Heat, and then us coming out and doing these songs like where Lindsay's playing like bassoon. And it was just like a total hoot. I mean, it's amazing how much time I really spent playing with David over the years, because even though UBU wasn't in effect, 81, 82, 83, 84, 85, I did lots of touring with David, made a bunch of records. That last record we made before we got together with UBU again, Alan Ravenstein was playing synthesizer, Jim's playing guitar, David Hild, the guy from The Girls, is playing drums, and Chris Cutler's playing... Actually, Chris Cutler wasn't playing drums on that record. I can't remember if he is or not, but I know...
He's from Henry Cow, right?
Yeah, he's from Henry Cow, and he has that label, Recommended Records.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy's written some amazing books. Like Chris Cutler, he's definitely someone to check out.
Yeah, I first saw him play with you guys. Well, you come back, I think, in 86, and two drummers. And
right,
Firehose plays with you at the Ritz, maybe 87.
Got back into the band. And, Mike, that was a lot of fun playing band with Chris Cutler on one side and Scott Krause on the other side.
Yeah.
That was just like, wow.
Yeah, they had completely different styles. But it meshed really well, the two different styles, to make this one drum sound. That was really wild. We were really wild by it.
Yeah, you know, Mike, I swear, I think Scott Krause is truly, like, one of the great, great, great drummers.
Yeah, I dig him big time.
He's just, you know, he's got a feel and a sound that's so great. And you know, Scott never really talks about it that much, but Scott knows a lot about art, and he really brings a lot of these concepts and ideas to the way he plays drums. Yeah, I miss playing with Scott. Like, I do a Christmas show every year in Cleveland, and you know, usually like Home and Garden plays. And
he's got his son singing for him, right?
What's that?
He's got his boy singing for him.
Yeah, like Keith is singing. Keith is like a really, really good performer.
And clarinet, like Alan?
Rocks some clarinet, and he can do a mean David Thomas when he wants to. Tom Herman was playing with us, too, because Tom's moved back to Cleveland. So the last, not this past Christmas show, but the two before, Tom came in. So you basically had, you had Robert Wheeler on synthesizer, and you had Scott, and you had Tom Herman, and you had Keith, and you had me. And we do a couple UBU songs. Stuff sounded really good.
Wow.
Some of that stuff, I think, is up on YouTube.
Alan lives in New York now.
Yeah, Alan lives uptown. I've gone up to see him a few times, but, you know, I've got this really busy schedule, and so does he, so I don't see him nearly enough. You know, I'd really like to see Alan again.
He flies airplanes.
Yeah, so he's still a traveling man.
He was the wildest synthesizer player. I was telling you, he's the first guy we saw that played one without a keyboard.
Yeah, the old EML 200, they basically invented that. Electronic Music Laboratories invented that. That's some outfit up in Connecticut. Their whole idea with that was to create something to teach kids in school how, like, sound can be modified. So that's, like, why the oscillator knob is huge, and then that goes, you have to patch out of that into, like, a VCA to amplify it, and then out of that, like, into a filter or into, like, an envelope generator. And it's all, you have to patch. It's, like, nothing's pre-wired for you there. I remember Alan got the EML 101, which does have a like a keyboard on it, and Yeah, he had a huge influence on me because in Home and Garden, like, I did a lot of the synthesizing stuff. And, you know, I used an EML because I love the way those things sound. And I still use it, like, you know, in that Book of Knots thing that Joel and Matthias and Carla and I do. There's tons of weird sounds, and some of them are from the EML.
Wow. Now, this second Ubuik goes on to the early 90s. I think I saw one of the last gigs you guys were opening for the Pixies.
Right.
And you became disenchanted.
Well, you know what happened was I started playing with other folks more than anything else, going out on the road with the Mekons and then doing those two Bob Mould records and touring with Bob and Anton. And then, you know, I had done some playing with Charles, with Frank Black, and then They Might Be Giants. So we're starting to work with other folks, and just kind of got to the point where I thought, you know, it was 1992. We had just finished Story of My Life, and I just thought, you know, I gave this thing 15 years. It's been a really good time. I'm going to, you know, take some time and do some other things and you know, maybe try to get a, you know, try to start a studio. And that's basically what I did.
You had moved to Brooklyn by this time?
Yeah, I moved up to Brooklyn like in 86. So all through those other years,
oh, wow, wait,
you know, I had other projects up here in New York that I was doing, like, had a live drum and bass thing with Yuval Gabay, who is the drummer from Soul Coughing.
Yeah.
And we were doing shows, and we did some recordings, and you know, I was playing with a lot of different people, and I just thought that, yeah, it was time to, you know, just, you know, take a break.
Right.
And then...
not for music, but from Ubu.
Yeah, from Ubu. And 2 years ago, David asked me if I wanted to do some shows with Ubu, like where we would be improvising freely, and also like some of the Ubu tunes to this man called X, the man with the X-ray eyes, which is this really funny, like science fiction Ray Milland film
about yeah.
This dude who comes up with the formula so that he can see, you know, like through walls and stuff.
Yeah, I remember that movie.
And that was like really good, Mike. It was really good to play with David again and like with Michelle and Robert and kind of just like, you know, with the old P-Bass again, playing Streetways, playing Heart of Darkness. And it felt really, really good. And, you know, I talk to David every now and then, and like, I talked to him about remixing something from that new record of theirs, but the studio here is really busy, and I haven't gotten around to that. But
yeah, talk about your studio, G, Studio
yeah, man,
G.
Yeah, Studio G Brooklyn, because that's, like, really what I've been doing since 1994. That's, like, when we broke ground here. My friend Neil Hoyne, my buddy from Cleveland, who I couldn't have done the studio without. He came down here, I remember it was July 10th, and we started, we had two rooms, two 25 by 25 foot rooms, and we built like a nice little live room and a control room, and this was like 95. And then a cat that I had been out on the road with, Sean Haney, came on board around 97. And he was a really good engineer. And he kind of brought the studio up to like a level like it was like a much more serious recording studio, not just a rehearsal demo kind of a situation.
Yeah.
And then he was with me for 2 years. And then he left and... Joel Hamilton, who I met just out on the street having coffee. He and I got to know each other, and I took him to a studio around the corner from my place, which was like a Neve studio, a much more established place, because my operation was so small back then, I couldn't really, like, afford to have another dude on board, you know. But one thing led to the other, and Joel kept stopping by and said, hey, you know, if anything ever comes up, you know, let me know. So something came up. Like, I remember it was like November 99. It was this band called Early Edison. And Joel came in and helped me produce that record. And from there, one thing led to the other. And now we've got like a two-track tape machine, Pro Tools, got a bunch of German mics, and we're getting a Neve console like in about a month. So our little studio went from being ADATS and like a Soundcraft ghost to like Neve Studer, you know, Neumann microphones. And now it's just so great because I'm still playing lots of bass, but now I can kind of help people make their records.
Yeah, but you still doing music. You got this Book of Knots.
The Book of Knots thing, man, we're so psyched about this because we, like Joel and I were talking the other day, and he said, you know, we didn't try to make this so that somebody would want to put it out, which is so true because, you know, like, when you're, like, on the other side of the glass recording, you know, dudes are coming in, they got their tunes, and they have a real definite idea of, like, what they want to do. And even if you're producing, like when I'm producing someone, I always feel like I'm trying to help them realize their vision more than really try to put my thumbprint on it. So, you know, you're in the service of people. And, you know, people are on a budget, so there's not a lot of time for tons of experimentation because, you know, we got to make this record. You know how it goes.
Yeah. That so, Jammy Cotto.
Right. That precisely. So when we have some downtime here at the studio, what we try to do is we try to do some things that might break a few of the old rules that, well, you would never do that. I mean, you would never put a microphone in a balloon and put it in a garbage can full of water and then, you know, kick the can for a bass drum sound. Because it would take too long and it would be too weird. But we've done stuff like that. I don't even think it was a balloon. I think it was like a Trojan. It was like so funny. We did so many different like things like this. We took a microphone downstairs into the subway. Just all the fun stuff that you want to do that you never really have the time to do.
Right.
So the first record is just called The Book of Knots. And that's like our collection of songs that are all nautical themes, like Boston to Bombay. And John Langford does like a kind of like a poem called The Captain's Cup, which he wrote this little story taken from the story of the Essex. This is the boat that the whale rammed and sank. And then these cats, they go off in three boats, and they're 2,500 miles off the coast of South America and how they get back. So John tells this story. And the music that is being played under the story is just like I'm playing acoustic bass and Matthias is playing a melodica with one hand and snare drum with the other hand. And Joel's playing like this little cowboy guitar, like a Maybell, just some strange tuning. And Carla's playing violin. So this is like one sound of the Book of Knots. Then the other sound that we have is like a big old heavy rock sound. And
but you're playing a lot of stand-up, huh?
Well, you know, not nearly as much as I should, you know. So I don't even really call myself a real stand-up player. Like, back in the day...
Yeah, when did you start on it?
Well, I started when I came up here, like in the 80s. I mean, I already had the bass. I mean,
I actually did a whole record with David called Monster Walks Winter Lake that's all improvised and is all on acoustic bass. So I had done some things with David as a duo with the acoustic. I remember I did some shows with Lucinda Williams while I was playing stand-up. We opened for Warren Zevon here in New York. I remember that. But the stand-up, Mike, you know, that's not like the electric
bass. Oh, I know that. I've tried it.
It's more like a violin. Like, you got to kind of stay up on it, or else, like, your intonation kind of will suck. So I'll always drag it out. You know, I'll always drag it out. Like, you know, like the Book of Nods, it's so nice to have the acoustic bass because it's such a totally different vibe than electric.
Do you bow?
You know who else I played a lot with? There is a woman here in New York. Her name is Angel Dean. Her and I had a duo where we play like rockabilly and country tunes. Like, we did that like for like a year, and then Bob called, and I kind of got called away, and it wasn't in town enough, and Angel went ahead and got herself a band. But something country, I'll always be able to do that.
Oh,
but,
yeah.
You know, like playing jazz on an acoustic bass, that's like a life's work.
Yeah.
And you can't just step to that. You got to... But you know what's nice? You know, man, you know what's really nice about the stand-up?
Yeah.
Even if you just have like a student model and you get the bow and you just sit there in your room and just bow the open strings.
Yeah.
It's like, it's a great thing for your brain, a great thing just for your music. And then also, when you get on the electric, the damn thing feels like a banjo. You know, like,
oh, yeah.
You can really scoot on it. You know?
It's like jogging at the beach and then
exactly,
getting on hard.
Yeah.
You know what I found really tough is like where the body meets the neck and your hands got to go sideways, different than an electric bass.
Exactly, man.
It's all the top of your hand, and those muscles have to get really strong.
Yeah, and, you know, there's no way. I mean, like, you know, I record these cats that come through, these young kids. They come in with these basses that are a couple hundred years old, cost $10,000,
$15,000,
$20,000.
Whoa.
And, like, those guys, they blow some bass, you know?
Yeah.
Like, those cats, like, they're rocking the bass, and it's always a pleasure to record someone like that. But seriously, you know, I would recommend to any bass player, you know, you find a student-like model, and then just keep it around. It's good for the heart and good for the soul.
Yeah, to make myself really have to learn, I made a record, a little single, where I did stand-up. It was so tough, though, you know, but it is a beautiful instrument. I love the way the sound goes into you. What electric bass is you own now?
Well, like the three main basses that I mostly record with these days are like the P. It's like a 58 reissue because my 66 Sunburst got stolen, sadly. I got a Jazz, a 66 Jazz with the EMGs, just like the ones that you put in Cura's bass.
Yeah.
And I got a Gibson EB2 with flat rounds for dubbing it up.
Yeah.
And with Langford, I actually used one of those gold tone banjo basses. It's a real banjo, but with bass strings on it. And it's got a pickup, too. So you can mic it, have it sound like a banjo, or you can use the pickup, and it sounds kind of like a Beatle bass.
Wow.
Yeah, like kind of thumpy, like a cross between a stand-up and a Beatle bass.
Wow, what are you using for amps?
Well, you know, my favorite speaker cabinet is always going to be the SVT, just because I love the way that thing honks. But depending on the gig, like I'll use like a 15-inch EV and then a cabinet with two 10-inch
like an Eden cabinet with the two tens.
Yeah, I got a few of those.
Or I got a sub that I'll rock once in a while. I just want to tell you about one other project I got going on, the Gotchu Peen Band, which are a bunch of dudes from up here in Brooklyn. And we're playing funk and kind of, you know, like we do a couple of like things that are have a sort of like Moroccan flavor. We do a couple things that have like a Colombian rhythm. And when we do like a show, we have like Colombian cat playing percussion. We have like a Brazilian cat playing percussion. We have a Brazilian horn player and then three other horn players from here in New York. A drummer who, like our drummer Chris Michael, he travels all around the world and he'll study like music and bring back the instruments from the country. So it's fun. It's this band of guys that are all kind of, well, the drummer's not really a rocker, but the two guitar players and myself, we're all coming from the rock thing. But it's a chance for us to study these other rhythms and then play them. So we're just getting our records today, like the drummer. Actually, I'm getting my records tomorrow. So I'm going to send you one of those.
Oh, thank you.
You can see what I've been up to here.
How would you say your bass playing's changed over the years? Is it because of the different cats you play with?
Yeah. You know, I think, I remember, like, I never recorded to a click before, you know? But, like, with Bob's stuff, you know, a lot of Bob's songs, like, he wrote to a drum machine. And so, of course, a drum machine, that's a click track.
Yep.
So, playing with Bob was the first time I'd, like, played that way, and
what about with a pick?
What's that?
With a pick, a plectrum.
Yeah,
they call it in
exactly
England.
Like with the pick and to the click, which is a different thing. And it took me a while to get used to that. But then with They Might Be Giants, same thing. Sometimes the pick, and also playing to stuff that was generated from, originally, like from. Like a drum track that was made in a computer. So, you know, in Uber we never played the clicks. I mean, I know you guys never did either.
We tried it a couple times in the studio. It was a nightmare. That cowbell in your headphone just dunk dunk dunk. It seemed pretty soon you'd have a twitch in your eye.
Oh, and a ring in your ear.
Yeah.
You know what the really good drummers do is. They'll, like, take the click themselves, and they make, like, a little, like, hi-hat-y, like, tambourine-y kind of thing that is to the click, and then everybody tracks to that.
Yeah.
More than anything else, I think that that's changed, I mean, the groove. Like, I remember I did this thing with Charles for this James Brown tribute record. We did a...
Yeah, I got a song on that, too.
No, wait a minute. Which one are you on?
We're the last song. It's me, Perkins, and Money Mark. Doing it. Remember James Brown? Sometimes he'd hug the label with a song where he'd play organ. So we did one of them.
Yeah.
And we called the band Broke Dick Dog. I got it from the Miles autobiography where he said, if you were dressed real nice, he said you were cleaner than a broke dick dog.
Right, you're Miles, man. I love that autobiography of his.
Yeah, it's wild.
But we did Popcorn. Which one did you guys do?
Oh, I can't even remember the name, but it's an instrumental, you know.
Yeah.
But we're the last one on that record, and I remember you and Charlie's tune. Yeah, Popcorn.
Yeah, so having to play that, man, you know, it kind of like brought me around. I mean, I've always dug reggae and funk. But I think, you know, I'm always going to be a rocker, but I love the funk, you know, and I love, like, the fact that...
What about R&B? Because you didn't mention James Jamerson. Were you ever listening to him?
Oh, God, yeah.
That cat had
James
a profound
Jamerson,
effect on me, too.
You know, James Jamerson, because, see, man, when I was going through high school,
every other song on the radio had James Jamerson as a bass player. You know, like that bass line, like in Bernadette, you know?
Oh, yeah.
That Four Tops tune. You know, all those Temptations songs, all those Supreme songs.
Up to early 70s, he's on What's Going On.
That's a huge record in my life.
Yeah, that's one of the greatest bass lines ever.
There's so many great bass players. You know what we should do? For the next spiel, maybe we'll do one on bass players. Because, there's so many bass players that we got to give respect to.
Yeah, absolutely.
We don't have the time today, but you know what? I think that would be a really fun one for us to do, you know?
Yeah, absolute. Oh, but there's another Book of Knots record.
Right, Train Eater. That's the one that you're on and Carla Boswitch is on. And
two Pedro people.
Yeah, man. Well, I think Carla Boswitch is on that same James Brown record. She does a version of Hot Pants.
Yeah.
It's really good. She's so funny, man.
Yeah.
I can hear her song. She sounds like a cross between Patti Smith and Diamanda Galas.
Yeah. She's a great singer.
Ripping and roaring. The second Train Eater, the second Book of Knots record, Train Eater, we got the title from the story that my friend Tom Sullins, who took the photo that is on the cover of the record. It's a picture of a blast furnace. And the blast furnace is the Train Eater, because what they do with an old blast furnace, when they, a blast furnace, they never turn it off.
Right.
When they finally turn it off and cut it up into pieces, what they'll do is they just throw the pieces and weld the pieces onto like a bunch of old train cars, and then they'll just push all those train cars with all these pieces of the blast furnace welded to it into another blast furnace. So, hence the name, Train Eater.
Yeah.
And Carla Kilstead, our violinist, she sings one of the songs where she takes on the character of the blast furnace, which she calls Old Number 6. It's going down. She's taking her last trip through town. Because basically, it's already been cut up. It's on the train, and they're pushing the train over to the other blast furnace. And, I got to say, Carla Kilstead, this lady, she's got a voice and a way of singing that is just so amazing. It's been so great to work with her, and our drummer, Matthias, is a great drummer. So we're having fun with this band. And so we finish our first record, and we're like, okay, we got to make another record. Like, so what are we going to make this record about? And we decide to make it about the Rust Belt. And this is like your tune, Pedro to Cleveland. I couldn't ask for a better way of drawing these. These juxtapositions between Cleveland and Pedro. There's so many things that are common to both of our hometowns. You know, like there's water. There's a lot of water. There's the trains and the ships, and there's all this movement and all this industry. But you have the beauty, of the water there as well.
Right.
So, and when we made this record, I made that little ambient piece of music just to give you something to work off of, and then you sent your stuff back to us, and like I was telling you on the phone, we were trying to do something else, to kind of put it into the fold of the record, and we ended up taking almost everything off except some of the sounds and your vocals and wrote a whole other piece of music for it.
Yeah,
so
I really...
Train Eater, we're not afraid to go, you know what? this worked last month, but it's not working this month, so let's do something else.
Into the blast furnace.
It's really, really good. And, you know, like with Rick Moody, the guy who does the last piece, the second last piece on the record, he writes this song about a company town and a wife that used to love the town, but now she hates the town because of what's happened, you know, and how, like, this fictional company, Hewlett Smithson, was everything to the people in the town, but then Hewlett Smithson left, and now there was no more jobs for people. And there's a whole cast of characters. John Langford does a song about his hometown, Newport, Wales, talking about the Russian sailors and the lady who owns the fish and chips joint and the prostitutes down at the pool hall and all these things that he experienced when he grew up. And then Tom Waits does a song. Like, we sent him, he liked one of our songs, so he said, send it to me on a 4-track cassette. So we had to put the music on 1 track of a 4-track cassette. Then apparently what Tom and his wife Kathy did, they went in the bathroom and sang in the shower to the 4-track. And then he put some guitar on it and then sent the tape back to us. So then we took those tracks off of the cassette and put them back in the Pro Tools, you know?
Right.
So,
into the blast furnace.
I got a funny note from him. You know, just doing that much, like for Tom Waits, I guess was like really challenging. He sent me this note where he goes, sorry it's taken me so long, but I've been in technical hell. But yeah, he had like John's song's called Boomtown. John Langford, man, that's a really special cat.
Yeah, yeah. An artist, too.
We've been doing stuff with John, too. I've been out on the road with John supporting, these organizations that are trying to abolish the death penalty here in the United States. You know what the scariest thing about the death penalty is? The scariest thing about the death penalty is the fact that there's a 50-50 chance that you could be killing the wrong guy because maybe he did it, maybe he didn't. It's like so many men on death row are there, like, on circumstantial evidence.
Yeah.
I mean, that's one really bad thing about it. The other really bad thing about it is killing a man doesn't bring the other person back.
Yeah.
So it's really, really wrong, and John's made a bunch of records, and I've contributed to some of those records with a band called the Pine Valley Cosmonauts, and the proceeds from those records went to the people who were organizing against the capital punishment in Illinois, and it got that got abolished. There is no more. There is no more capital punishment in the state of Illinois. And we were just out in Montana, and the Senate voted there to abolish the death penalty, and so now it's got to go to the House. And we were also out in Seattle where a bunch of people are trying to get the death penalty abolished in Seattle, but the governor there isn't letting it happen, and she's a Democrat. I don't know what her name is, but politicians are afraid to rock the boat. They're afraid to look like they're soft on crime, which is ludicrous, man. Like the death penalty and being soft on crime, two totally separate things.
Yeah.
So I'm really happy. You know, I'm proud to be working on something like that with someone, and working with John, you know, lets me do that.
Do you guys record at the G, Studio G?
The name of our band is Ship and Pilot, and we've got like 6 songs that we recorded that we're in the process of working on now.
Damn.
Yeah, man, I've had some fun people at Studio G, man.
You think working in the studio?
What's that, Mike?
You think working in the studio, you know, on the other side of the glass, has changed the way you do bass?
Oh, yeah.
Because of the perspective? Yeah.
Yeah, so much. I see some, like, young kid in there playing bass, and, you know, 1 minute he's hitting the strings really hard, and the next minute he's playing them kind of soft. And, you know, so there I am. I'm looking at the dude through the glass, and I'm thinking, now, you know, this is this dude's bass part. He worked on this part. I can't just hit the talk button and go, yo, don't hit the bass so hard. That's not going to be good. You have to try to, you know, you come up with ways to kind of help someone see that, you know, to really get your bass to sweat the cones, you don't really need to smack it. But if you need to smack it, and if you need to smack it to make it happen, then I'm going to work with you on that. However, if you're smacking it 1 minute and then playing it really soft the next minute, it's not going to make for a recording that's as complimentary to your bass part as you might think it is. And it's just.
So it's perspective. So like.
Just perspective.
You using that experience when you got the bass in your hand. Are you thinking those things? Because this is a problem I've had. I'm so close to my machine, you know, it's hard to know the other world or the rest of the world.
But the thing is now, dudes have, like, inboxes at home. Like, kids got Pro Tools at home.
Yeah.
And they can plug their bass in themselves. And they can see that, like, when you pick your hand up and go, bam, and hit that E string, that makes a wave that the computer records. And then when, like, you go up on the G string and play a couple notes up there with your fingers, that makes another kind of waveform. And I would think that same kind of recognition, that same kind of knowledge that I have sitting in front of a computer is up for grabs now.
Yeah.
I mean, digital recording is definitely in the hands of the masses. And, like, that's what I would tell anybody that's going in the studio. It's like, before you go into the studio, grab yourself a 4-track. It can be a cassette 4-track, or now they got the digital ones, or you can even get, like, a little Pro Tools rig. They're pretty cheap now. Like, an M-Box, you can get a used M-Box for $200. Turn your laptop into a computer.
Yeah, yeah.
Because nothing makes, I don't think anything makes a bass player or any kind of a musician a better player than playing. Like, the more you play, like you say, like you're close, you feel so close to your machine, like the more we play, the tighter we get with our instruments. And I would say the second most important thing is to record yourself. Because if you come up with a cool lick, go ahead and throw it down on anything. You can throw it down on the cheapest cassette player money can buy, or you can put it into any kind of little digital recording program, GarageBand, anything, because you're going to learn when you record yourself what you do on your machine, like what the implications of that, what the implications are to the recording. And that's like where people can learn on their own time instead of spending the big bucks at the studio. It's like record the band, you know, record yourself. Like the more you record, the better understanding you have of the recording process. Just like the better understanding you have of your bass, the more you play.
Right.
So for me, getting on the other side of the glass has been like truly really, really changed my way of, just the way I realized it. And it's so funny, too, Mike, because look at all the records you make, you know? And you'd think you'd learn something there, and you do learn something there, but not as much as sitting there yourself and recording yourself, or recording, like, your drummer, or recording your guitar player, just with a 57, you know?
Yeah. But I also think you got a great perspective from coming from many years and many gigs, many, you know, it's a, that's, that, that can't be just done, you know, it has, I mean, it can't be just, brought forth, it has to be done. So, you're in a unique situation, and I think you got a lot to share with people. Tony, I want to thank you a lot for coming aboard and, sharing some of this stuff with the listeners and myself.
Man, Mike, it's always so great talking to you. So maybe when the seasons change a couple of times, we'll get back together and we'll talk about some more stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, and I can't wait to do some recording at Studio G.
Whoa.
I will.
Wow. Mike, that's going to be fun.
Wow.
Just let me know when you want to come and I'll clear the time, man. That's just going to be for old time's sake and for no other reason.
All right. Great. Well, I got a tour. I got to leave for a tour tomorrow and getting ready here. Thanks again for being on a Watt from Pedro show. And like I said, Sharon, great stuff. I owe you so much for all the years. So thank you. And then all the stuff to come.
Hey, man. Love to you, brother Mike.
Big love back, Tony. Oh, it's all happening.
Lot from Pedro Show. That was Now with Song. Well, you know. Before that, we had the Lil Johnny Jewel from Television, something live. First time they went to Cleveland in 1975. Tony was saying something about that gig, place called Piccadilly Inn. I guess he was a bartender there during the time. And, of course, before that, we had the second part of the interview I did with him this morning. Sorry. A little bit of hack, a little bit. I mean, he's not a cigarette now. The rest of that spiel with Tony. And he's a great brother, man. And I'm glad he took the time out there to spiel with us all here. Yeah, tomorrow I leave for D.C. Because the Stooges tour starts there Thursday. And hopefully early Thursday I'll get a chance to walk around the by the Jefferson Memorial there, because there's like almost 7,000 cherry trees, and it's the last day of the peak blossom period, you know, for the our version of Sakura. So that'll be a trip. Hold tight for our three. Walk from Pedro Show, April 3rd, 2007. Third hour of the Watt from Pedro Show. Here's part 10 of Jack Flanders and the Ghost Islands.
Well, no, there's nothing here. It's empty.
I don't know about that.
Hello? Anyone?
Just us chickens.
It's empty, Mocho.
I don't think so.
What are you seeing that I'm not?
It's not what you see. It's what you feel. There's stuff in here. Furniture, books. There's a lot of stuff.
Mocho, it's bare.
No, I feel chairs. And there's a table over there.
Show me a chair.
There's one right here.
Well, okay. I'd like to see you sit down on it.
I need more than a char root to do that.
So it's not solid, but it's here?
You can pass your hand through it. But if we stayed here a while, I bet you'd be able to sit down.
Wait a minute. I think I am beginning to see things, but it feels like I'm seeing them behind me.
That's right. You start with what you can sense behind you, and then what you can see out of the sides of your eyes, and finally to where you can look at it straight on.
So I have to unfocus so I can focus.
They've even got paintings hanging on the walls.
God, you're right. I can see them.
Have you looked out that back window here?
I know. Why?
Come over here. Take a look.
What do you see?
See if you see what I see.
It's the ocean.
But which ocean?
We can't see the ocean from here. We're in a valley.
But you're seeing something.
I can even hear it.
Let me see if the outside has changed since we've been inside.
Well, I sure hope not.
No, nothing's changed out here.
Well, that's a relief. I think.
I'm getting the feeling that we're not alone.
Are we being watched?
Maybe they can feel us from a distance?
Mojo, this is all very interesting, but we have to find Bunny. Now, time is running out.
I don't feel she's here. I think she's somewhere else.
Let me try to reach Claudine again.
I never asked to be Jeanne d'Arc.
I don't think they're planning to roast you.
Why are you like this? Why aren't you frightened?
They're waiting for us.
Yes, of course. They want to feed off us. Look at how many there are now.
If Jack were here, he'd say you're too thin for them to eat.
Don't you see? In this cave, everyone else is a mummy. There's no meat.
Claudine, are you there?
Jack, I'm here.
Are you okay?
They have found us.
Thousands of them. There are thousands of them.
No.
Did she say thousands?
Have you found the bunny?
No, and time is running out.
I know.
I'm going to talk to the Lucanuna. They want to eat us. No, they do not.
Dominique, you're too skinny.
See? What did I say?
Dominique.
Mojo, are you coming to help us?
I'll tell you what you gotta do.
What? Tell me.
If you hear them chanting, ooga booga, ooga booga, what you do is look down at your sneakers and you say, feet don't fail me now.
Funny? You are all insane.
We're coming, but it's going to take a while.
In less than a while, we will be joining the honored ones. Do you understand?
No, but listen, just stay put and we'll get there as soon as we can. Mojo, what do you think?
I don't know. What's the honored ones? Oh,
beats me. I think where they are is over at that end of the island.
Well, maybe I'm turned around, but I think it's that way.
Oh, great.
What are you doing? I'm going to talk to them.
Jack said wait here.
If we waited here, we will vanish with the island.
Do you see how many there are? Do you see how they are pulsing? Lighter, darker, lighter, darker.
Then stay there.
Jack? Mojo? Anyone?
What the hell?
Claudine, are you there?
Jack, she is one of them.
What's that?
She is speaking in their fuzzy tongue.
Do you mean Claudine?
She's out there talking to them.
Well, tell her to ask them how long before we all disappear. Man, this is getting weirder all the time.
Can't you hear me? Claudine is one of them.
And don't forget to ask about Bunny. Now,
we're on our way.
Yeah, but which way?
Shut up. Hang on, Dominique. We'll be there soon.
Who'd have thought she could speak fuzzy tongue? My, my.
Mojo, it's starting to get light.
We ought to be able to see San Miguel from up here, but I don't see it.
Yeah, I know.
I think this island is saying San Miguel adios.
It's not looking good.
Dominique, come out here.
No.
It's safe.
You're one of them? Are you?
Do I look fuzzy?
Why do you know their language?
I don't have time to explain. We have to hurry.
What are they? They are so sweet.
Neither. Dominique, please. The island is disappearing. Please.
You're not one of them?
No, I am not.
All right, I'm coming.
Dominique, this is Una Kunka.
Uyuka told you, Banganutu.
Did he say Okapoka?
No. Una, Lugamutu go?
Managa.
Come on, Dominique. They'll take us to Bunny. Come on, we have to run.
The ground is funny.
Come on, you can run faster than that.
I think so.
Oh, we have to keep up.
I'm running after them?
Come on, come on. They're leaving us behind.
Oh, I could move that fast too. He thought I did was float up off the ground.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay, we started out the third hour with part 10 of Jack Flanders and the Ghost Islands. Only one more part to go, so stay tuned for that thrilling conclusion. Jack trips his way through another adventure. Then we had Don't Think, Feel by Funky Gong. And then Stupid by Yumi Yumi. You know, that should be my theme song. Last show I played Idiot by Yumi Yumi. And maybe both of them, you know. My first and middle name. No, Stupid will be the first one. Idiot, the middle one. So that'd be Stupid Idiot Watt. Wouldn't that be a better name for me? Here's a great band from Holland called The X. Watt from Pedro Show.
You know how it feels when you're standing at the gates and the doors are locked and everybody hesitates. Hesitates to open their minds, to raise some blinds, to take an opportunity to see what's going on outside. Who says, open the border, smell the low-end odor of the universal, uniformal, unified force, right? Dream come true of a badass painter. What's it gonna be this time? A creepy suit dictator, a business boom creator, a high-rise simulator. Walls might fall down when it's a dig the decorator. You talk about pollution, this is no solution. This is the fusion of con man, the fusion of con man in a world of confusion. And I want no choice of walking on white or black street, or dance to a one-way blurry gray dead and beat, or somebody telling me what to do, what to do, what to do, or who to meet. If I want to make a stand, it's on my own 2 feet. And I seriously believe in things are spontaneous, people all around me being simply miscellaneous. That should be obvious. No need for boring faces in a nag-nag oasis who don't like nothing but the safe, stupid places.
We'll be right back. Giving us your opinion of the John Birch Society. Are you a member?
That's what I was going to ask you, whether you are. And if you are not, what your opinion was.
Are you a member?
I'm not sure that that's significant at this point.
I'm not sure that your question's significant.
No, I'm not a member.
I am a member.
are creating an unhealthy, divisive, and dangerous climate for children in
from Pedro Show. Started that one with Livewire by the X. Then we had Corny Love Song from Frog Women. That's some music from Italy there. Something from Hollywood, I think. The Illuminoids, who do this thing called mashup, where you take two songs and mash them together. Sort of what Danger Mouse did with the, what was that thing called? The Gray Record or something? He took a Jay-Z Black album and did it with Beatles White album or something. Anyway, that was called Forming You, and there's a Ramones song and a Germ song there. They do one with somebody else, Eminem and somebody. I think we were talking about last show. With those guys. They wrote me an email to come on the show. They're nice cats, though. Stefan and James. Yeah. You just heard Are You a Member by... Now, I don't know how you pronounce this. They're from France. And it's spelled P-Z-L-E-N, so... Plen? Pzlen? Pzlen? Pzlan? I don't know. Coming up now, I got Tommy from Estelle, this great Irish band from Dublin, Ireland. He's a guitar player, and he's got his own project now called Deep in the Woods 66. And here's a tune from him called Dunno. We'll be right back. 1-0-0. That was terrible. When he was talking about Chad Spiegel, the first album, it's a tune called Chinese Radiation. And we had a husband before that was able to read it. Experienced someone by a family of white folks, and before that was Star Off and Gunner Old Night. Deep in the Woods, 66.
My pre-show
here. And the day before, Balin for tour. Hopefully I get get to see it. Experience a full bloom. And then play gig. I think it's going to be over the internet on NPR, National Public Radio, NPR.org. And they'll probably be archived. So hear us do the cherry gig for the tour. Hey, Cherry Blossoms, cherry gig. That's great. And then, you know, I got this other project coming in May 6th, in Brentwood. Somebody's pad. But it's with Petra. I have a new duo with her, a twofer band called Pelican Man. And I've been waiting a long time to start. I did a duet with her last year sometime, but writing songs for her and stuff. And she's going to start composing too, which is kind of new for her. She's always done other people's music, so very interesting. Petra's quite a talent with singing and, of course, with violin too. And she's working on a solo album, another one, a cappella, about show tunes. Movie songs, movie themes, not show tunes. Should be show tunes. Not pet. And I also got some Missing Men and Dose when I get back, too. Oh, yeah, Missing Men gets to open for Melt Banana. I know the Boss Man and Sacto putting on the gig, and I played with them before, and they're an intense, extremely intense band, and, I think I played with them in Orlando, and we got them up on, I think it was with a pair of pliers, Vince and Tom. And we got them on stage to do Bob Dylan wrote propaganda songs with us, but it was a trip for them. I don't think they knew where we were. They were playing along, though, somehow. Let's see here. We maybe should play some more music, huh? Oh, yeah, here's a song, this cat. Said he was, kind of riffing on History Lesson. The second one, the one on Double Nickels. Speaking of Double Nickels, there's a new book out about it. You know, part of that 33 and a Third series where people write about an album. And this cat came to Pedro from Boston, Michael Fournier. I wonder how you pronounce that. Sorry, Michael. A very nice man and very into the record and asked me a lot of stuff about it. And it's coming out. You can go to the Hoot page. There's a place to do orders on it. And let's see. That's not a book, but it's a magazine. I'm on the cover of Bass Player. Oh, yeah. You know, at the end, yeah, this is embarrassing because I must have been... The writer man, Brian, I must have been mumbling or screwing something up because it's all out of context. I got to write him about that because especially the Fudenori stuff where I'm discussing that, it's not what I meant, you know. I wasn't talking about that kind of music doesn't have time. It was like I couldn't hold time. I play like it's rubato. And I don't think... It's crazy. Shamisen or Shansin is a crazy Jap banjo, you know. It's a beautiful instrument. It's beautiful music. This Okinawa traditional song CD I got, Miss Kaori, you know. I'm trying to learn from it, and it seems kind of like I'm, I don't know, kind of weirding on it, but. I meant to pay tribute and stuff, so, but it was very nice of the bass player people to talk to me and have me on there like that. I guess I just talk like an idiot sometimes. You know, I'm always afraid to read those things till they come out, and then, or even way after they come out, I mean, because they usually don't run them by you first, but even when I got it, I hadn't read the thing until this morning, and it was like, oh, man. But most of it's okay. I didn't stumble over myself too much. I think the whole idea of bass for me is a way to help me learn about life, and, you know, and I'm always going to be learning, and that's why I was trying to get across to people about it. I've just been lucky to play with some incredible, generous people, and I'm very grateful for that. So anyway, here's this young man. His band is the New Preach Baby Exchange, the Watt from Pedro Show.
The windshield was cracked, and there was a tuba in the back seat. No AC, but the tape deck was good. So we cruised through the streets of Sarasota with the windows rolled down, blasting Maynard Ferguson, or the New Chemical People. I can't remember which. As a casual observer, we were just driving in circles, just a couple of young punks in a car with nothing to do. But it wasn't true. Me and Scott Ward, we were looking for someone with a record player. We decided we'd swing by his grandpa's place. His grandpa gave us boys Coca-Cola, took us out to the carport where the turntable was, collecting dust. We plopped down in a couple of old lawn chairs and commenced reclining as the needle dropped on Scott's new 7-inch. It was Black Flag, playing Louie Louie. When the song was over, Scott's grandpa got up and carefully lifted the record off the spindle. He cleared his throat, shook his head, and said, "You know, these are different times. People nowadays don't think their song's any good unless they got all them dirty words in it. Me? I prefer Glenn Miller."
That was a trip. It's called "Still Shaking It, Boss" by a Rothschild agent. And before that, we had "History Lesson 1995" by the New Preach Baby Exchange. And yeah, we're coming to the end of another Watt from Pedro show. The April 3rd, 2007 edition, the day before I bail for the tour. I'm bringing the snowball mic, and with the aluminum purse, I'll be able to do some Watt from Pedro shows from the road there. And hopefully Scotty and Steve McKay and yeah, maybe Ronnie, some other folks will join me. And get to give you some radio show from a Stooges tour kind of experience or something. I'm looking forward to it. It's our first full U.S. tour. Well, yeah, full for the Stooges, I guess. It's the month of April, and hopefully we come back around and do the towns in Miss, which is quite a few. I mean, it's not like a Watt tour, but still, I'm big time looking forward to it and going to play my heart out. Hope to see you out there. Keep your powder dry.